Taking a look at the world of wildlife for the next hour with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Glad to have you listening in. Questions for Scott, call us at 800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. And as I said, it'll only be an hour today because we'll be going to President Obama's conversation on comments at noon today. Scott, welcome back.
It was great to be here.
Boy, is there lots going on. The Deer Hunt 2010 season opens November 20th, the nine-day season.
Yes, it's it's one of those things. You know, there's so many deer seasons that for the non-hunter, it's hard for the hunters to keep them straight. But for the non-hunter, it must be baffling. But the traditional nine-day, based on Thanksgiving week season, opens 2 weeks from Saturday on the 20th. And, I mean, that's still for most people. That's deer season.
Yeah.
I've come to largely ignore a lot of the rest of the stuff. But and the other issue is Deer Hunt 2010, which is the TV show on public television that leads up to the deer season, will be aired on November 11th on public television across the state. So that's the one that's hosted by Dan Small, sponsored by the DNR, and it'll be at 8 o'clock on the 11th. And they talk about, you know, stories about deer hunting, thoughts on how the season's going to go. It's just a fun thing for people who are at all engaged to kind of get psyched up for the deer season.
So November 11th.
November 11th at 8 o'clock on the Wisconsin channel of Wisconsin Public Television across the state.
All right. Joe in Oshkosh has a question or comment for you, Scott. Joe, hello.
Hello. Thank you. Yeah, a while back in the magazine Wisconsin Natural Resources, there was an article about the Kirkland warbler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A very rare bird that suddenly turned up in central Wisconsin living in jack pines.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I read the article, and it went on to talk about how jack pines proliferate, you know, how they become more, that they need a fire to get the cones or whatever to make more jack pines.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I've lived in a lot of parts of the state. I've seen jack pines in a lot of areas. So I just wonder if that's true. I mean, how could I be seeing jack pines all over the state? And were there fires all over the state at one time?
Well, there were widespread fires at one point. But jack pines have something that's called a serotonous cone, and it's kind of welded together, so to speak, by Mother Nature, and it takes the heat of a fire to break it open and release the seeds. Even so, I'm not a forester, and if there are folks involved here who want to chime in, I think there are other ways for these trees to propagate, and some propagation occurs even in the absence of fire. But the primary means of getting a big stand of uniform jack pine, which is what the Kirtland warblers like, is a widespread fire, which opens up the cones, distributes the seeds, and boom, you get a bunch of jack pine. But as you say, there are scattered jack pines here, there, and everywhere. So that's not necessarily all a result of fire.
So there you go, Joe. And you're Joe's calling from Oshkosh, which reminds me to mention to you, and you know about the deer hunting exhibition that is at the Oshkosh Museum. Joe, if you haven't seen it, you should probably get over there, and so should everybody else. What's it about, Scott?
Apparently, it's an exhibition at the Oshkosh Museum, as you said, that features our rich deer hunting heritage in Wisconsin and talks about traditions like deer camps and all the activity, the pre-hunt activity and everything that goes into the hunt.
I'm sure there's lots of photos.
There should be lots of photos, and I'm told that it's very well done. And that there's, I mean, they've actually up until now been a little surprised that it hasn't generated more interest than it has, given the fact that we do put 650,000 people in the woods 2 weeks from Saturday, and all their families are impacted and everything else. So for folks interested in something else to get them pumped up about the upcoming deer season, the Deer Hunting Heritage exhibit at the Oshkosh Museum would be a good thing to go spend a little time at.
Yeah.
And apparently there's a website. If you go to the it's www.oshkoshmuseum.org, and then I think once you get on the website, you can probably link to the deer hunting exhibit, which is called Deer Hunting Wisconsin's Autumn Tradition. So, should be worth doing.
Actually, it really should. I'll try and put that up on my Facebook page, too, in case people miss the address or forget. We'll put it back up there. I'd like to see it myself.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, I will say, even if you don't hunt, just to learn about there's such a strong tradition of hunting in this state, even if you're not a hunter, it could be a very interesting exhibit.
It's a big deal. It's a big deal every year, and it's hard to imagine that there are very many people in the state who aren't somehow impacted, either with a family member out or a friend or somebody gives
business.
Them some venison, or businesses that, oh, sorry, we don't have any employees this week, or, you know, the logging companies basically shut down. Everybody wants to hunt. It's a huge economic engine and a huge social engine, and it's important ecologically, too. A lot of deer will be harvested, and that's important in keeping the herd in check. So,
Dave in Fish Creek, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Dave.
Well, good morning. I have a couple of coyote questions. Coyotes, are they normally Democrats or Republicans? No, I'm just saying. seriously, though, people, you know, I live in northern Door County where we seemingly have a good coyote population. And every once in a while, it sounds like there's about 100 of them that are just carrying on like crazy. And people have said it's because they've found something to eat or whatever. And I guess my first question is, what makes them all of a sudden start to yelp like crazy? And then second, coyotes seemingly are more and more plentiful all the time. Is there anything in particular that causes that? And I'll leave it at that and take my answer off the air.
All right. Yeah, thanks for calling, Dave.
Well, first of all, Dave, in terms of why they all of a sudden go nuts yelping and howling and so forth, it's probably truly only known to the pack of coyotes at the time. But the ones that frequent my property south of Madison, you know, it seems like it's absolute dead silence. You don't hear anything. And then all of a sudden one night, like you said, they'll just go crazy. And they're howling and yipping and yapping. In part, that's all part of their social communication and keeping the group together. And it may be when there's young pups out that everybody's talking to try and get back together, or somebody's been separated, or there is something that stirs them up. Either they've been agitated by something they perceive as a threat, or they've found a food source, or 101 possible reasons. But the fact is, all that yipping and yelping is their means of communicating with each other, since they're a fairly social animal. In terms of them being plentiful, they are plentiful, they have been plentiful, they will be plentiful, and they've been plentiful for a long time. And they're probably more plentiful than most people realize, since frequently coyote sightings are sometimes dismissed as, oh, it's a farmer's dog out in the field or whatever. They are certainly around, they're statewide, and they're quite abundant, but relatively secretive. So
there you go. Rebecca in Platteville, on to you.
Hi. I have a question. I have, every year, annually, I have these coon hunters that I live kind of below the ridge, and so they shine my property, which is posted, and the light goes across my house into my living room sometimes, which gets my dogs all agitated. Half of my land is woods. I have a little over 9 acres. What is my recourse?
So for lights going in your house, they're not trespassing?
But they're shining, and they're not really actually standing on my property. They're shining with this big spotlight, and they go through the tops of my trees. They hit my house. They go through my living room. My dogs get all upset. I'm afraid to let the dogs out in case they would tangle with their dogs.
Yeah, okay.
Well, first of all, Rebecca, there are other reasons why people travel around at night shining spotlights into fields and woods. Some of it may be coon hunters looking for a place to hunt or looking for coons, but some of it's also people out looking for deer. And in some cases, just people, you know, I have a QB I carry occasionally, and I try and keep it out of people's houses, but sometimes you just want to take a look out over an open field and see what might be out there. The reality is that if they're not coming onto your property, I suspect that, you know, there's not a whole lot you can do, much the same as if you live on a curve in the road and people taking the curve with their high beams on are shining their headlights in your living room. I mean, that's in part inadvertent, more so than perhaps the hunters or shiners who are just looking for wildlife, either for whatever purpose, which could be just recreational looking.
Yeah.
I think it might be a bit of a I can see where it might be a bit of an annoyance, but I really don't think, short of trying to figure out who they are and asking them if they'd avoid the house, that there's much you can do.
Yeah.
Last summer, I was at a cabin up in Minocqua, 2 o'clock in the morning, and all of a sudden the whole cabin was lit up with, like it was blinding light. I said, oh my God, what's that? And all of a sudden these two giant lights out on the lake. Well, it turned out it was a loon banding crew, and they band the loons at night with a high-powered spotlight, and it would bounce off the water, or they'd flash around looking for loons. It was a, you know, so it happened for 15 minutes, and that was the end of it. I don't think there's much you can do here, Rebecca.
Well, there you go. Thank you for calling. Ruth in Russ County, we're on to you now. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I heard you talking about the hunting art exhibit in Oshkosh, I think it was.
Yeah.
So we also have a little one here in Russ County. It's in at the Pioneer Bank in Ladysmith, and it's called The Hunt in Russ County. It's photographs, paintings, and artifacts. So it should be somewhat interesting to people going hunting around here.
Yeah. Okay, so that what town is that in?
In Ladysmith.
In Ladysmith.
The Pioneer Bank.
Pioneer Bank in Ladysmith. Yeah. Okay, well, another good one.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah. Bye.
It's another, I mean, these are all examples of just how important, as you said, that the deer hunting tradition is, that banks and museums and art galleries and so forth at this time of year feature things related to this hunt. It really is a big event.
Ladysmith and
Pioneer Bank.
Pioneer Bank.
Pioneer Bank.
Okay, because I'll put that up on my Facebook page too, so people can just to alert people to it. Okay, very good. And you can join in too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org with your wildlife question. Scott, you know, one of the things I enjoy is if you have some pheasants or you have some venison, is eating it, and game cooking has gotten to be quite a little art.
It is. It's very popular, particularly with people who hunt. I'll be involved now since I have a couple pheasants in the refrigerator after this morning. But in any event, you don't necessarily have to be a hunter to be interested in game cooking.
No.
There are many other ways you might come by game meat. It's frequently gifted from hunter to neighbor or friend or family member. Sharing the harvest is an important thing for many hunters. So you may be given some game meat. In some cases, people salvage highway mortality and end up with game meat that way, with, say, a road-killed deer. And, of course, it's also provided through some of the Share Your Harvest and Share Your Hunt networks in terms of providing food for the needy. So game cooking is a pervasive thing in Wisconsin, and it's a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun.
For me, game cooking kind of closes the loop from the whole situation. You prepare for the hunt, you go hunting, you're lucky enough to harvest something. Okay, now you've taken care of it in the field, you've gotten it home, you've properly cared for it, so you have a quality product to work with. And then you want to select a recipe that's going to feature the qualities of the game in question, so that whoever you're sharing it with at dinner, whether it's the family or guests who are coming over, get a really neat experience. And that's really important, surprisingly important to a lot of hunters. And there are, oh my God, there are cookbooks, like they're
right
all over the place now.
And you know, your comment about non-hunters enjoying it, you and I have taught wild game cooking classes in the past, and I think there were probably more non-hunters than there were hunters in those classes.
Yeah, as I recall, that was a long time ago, but boy, those classes were a lot of fun. And we, as a matter of fact, listeners should be aware that by hopefully, I don't know, somewhere 6 months down the road, there are plans to redo the cookbook that came out of that class called Wisconsin Wild Game Enjoying the Harvest. And we're going to solicit a lot of new recipes and upgrade that. And we'll be featuring that on the program.
Yeah, absolutely. Pat in Green Bay has a question or comment for you, and we'll get to Pat in just a minute. But I want to remind you, our guest today, Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Larry Mueller here. Jim Packard, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Public Radio is having an open house this Sunday. I'm going to be involved in it. We'll be at our studios in Madison. You are invited to attend. This is a fun event. It's free. It's celebrating our 20th anniversary of the Ideas Network. And so it's this Sunday, November 7th, from 1 to 4 p.m., and I'll be there talking to folks. And Gene Faraca, Ben Marins, Michael Feldman, Joy Cardine, a whole lot more will be present. You can tour the studios. Record your own story about your favorite public radio network. We'll have some great food and live music right here on the UW-Madison campus. And I'd invite you to go to our website, WPR.org. There's a link for the November 7th open house on the homepage. I also have it on my Facebook page as well. You can find it there, too. But that's going to be a lot of fun this Sunday from 1 to 4, right at our studios here at Wisconsin Public Radio. And I did want to mention, yesterday we had Lewis Wasserman and Karen Connolly on to talk about their book, Wisconsin's Own, 20 Remodeled or 20 Wonderful Homes. It's published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. The Allen Mansion House is the cover house. It was on the cover of their book. And they're having an open house in Delavan on November 11th at 7 p.m. And then also the authors will be at Borders in Sherwood Hills, Madison, for a book signing on the 7th of December at 7 p.m. So I just wanted to mention those as well. But this Sunday, come on out. We'll be talking to you. Let's go to Pat now in Green Bay. Hi, Pat.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What can we do for you?
Well, in answer to, I think her name was Rebecca with the spotlighting problem.
Yes.
I think she does have some options, and I think in our big game hunting regulation book, the spotlighting thing, and I'm not against spotlighting because once in a while we like to do it ourselves, but I think it shows disrespect for the landowners when they go through and they spotlight, you know, they shine them into buildings and everything else. And I think in that big game hunting book, I think it almost says that you can't do that. You can't show that into people's houses. And if she would get her number, get their license plate numbers or whatever, she could turn that into the sheriff's department and turn that in. And they should be able to go talk to these people and say, hey, listen, this is what you're doing, you know.
Yeah.
And they should back off and show some disrespect for that.
Well, I think you're certainly right about the respect issue, whether it's but it's hard to tell in a question like that if you're waving the light around, whether it's inadvertent or they're sitting out there thinking, oh, let's shine it in. But you're right. If she could get a license plate or a tag number or anything else or even some tip on who they might be, then the sheriff or possibly even the warden could investigate that.
Yeah. I think it sounded to me like in this case they were shining it through the woods. They may not have even known the house was there. That was the issue.
That could be the case, like you say, it'd be inadvertent, you know, with the light going through there. But if she's having a problem with it, I wouldn't hesitate to contact the sheriff's department with a license plate number, or like you said, the game ward.
Yeah,
can't hurt. It might throw a little scare into them, and they'll shine somewhere else.
Yeah, shed a little light on the issue, and a different kind of light, though. Thanks, Pat. That's a good point. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, Scott, one of the things we're seeing, I think we have more wolves in the state now than we've had in a long time, and there's some volunteer efforts out there, aren't there?
Well, yes. There is always interest in maintaining as close a population estimate as can be received. I think, let me look here at this handout. I think the estimate, let's see. Well, this is related to the volunteers last year. Between 690 and 733 wolves, including 655 or more outside the Native American reservations. But the opportunity here is that the DNR has a call out soliciting volunteers needed to help monitor wolf populations in the state, as well as other forest carnivores. The point here is that for people who are interested in spending a little time out of doors during the winter, they do a very extensive system on forest roads in the northern part of the state, looking for tracks of these various forest carnivores. Fishers,
yep.
Mountain lions, wolves, yeah. Coyotes, and so forth. And there are three training sessions coming up. Let's see. There's one this weekend in Ashland, December 4th in Babcock, and December 11 and 12 in Tomahawk. And the bottom line is if somebody thinks, hey, that would be kind of cool to be trained as a tracker and to get out there and collect some information, spend some quality time outdoors, collect some useful information on populations of these animals, then my suggestion is you get a hold of the DNR, their mammal people at the Park Falls office, make a request, find out where these are from the DNR website, and heck, sounds like it'd be fun to me.
Yeah, sounds like a lot of fun. Sharon and Baraboo, on to you. Hi, Sharon.
Hello. Hi. I have a question about the deer population in terms of the number of deer that are killed every year on the road.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the state takes those numbers and calculates the, you know, calculates how many deer are actually killed on the roads. The other thing, too, is my job kind of takes me out driving quite a bit, mm-hmm. and I've been noticing a lot of deer trapped in these construction zone areas, and I don't know if there's, I mean, it's just really sad to be driving by them several days, weeks in a row, and they're still there.
What do you mean by trapped in a construction zone?
Well, they're dead, but they're like right in the middle of all these, because there's so much highway construction that's going on. And it looks as if like these construction sites are becoming traps for the deer too. So the deer have no way to escape, so to speak. But it would just be nice if they could actually haul these things out of the way. They're car hazards as well.
Yeah.
Well, you've brought up a whole bunch of good stuff, Sharon. First of all, we wanted to issue a bit of a caution for the state's drivers, including you, Sharon, because the rut, the breeding season for white-tailed deer, is in full swing right now. The archery hunters are out there taking advantage of that in full swing, and deer are going to be running every which way for the next week or two. And then the deer season starts, and that also is a peak of activity. The point being, right now, drivers in rural areas, and even not-so-rural areas, should be extremely cautious early in the day, late in the day, and frankly, when these bucks are rutting and thinking about
nothing but sex,
nothing but finding does, you can end up with a deer vehicle problem at high noon or midnight. But certainly the peaks of movement are still early and late in the day. So please be careful out there. Deer are really going to be on the move. The next issue you asked about how many of these are hit.
The insurance companies keep pretty good track.
The insurance companies and in some cases the sheriffs and DOT track reported accidents. And usually those numbers somewhere in the 20,000 plus range. But I think there are large numbers of deer that are hit and go unreported, or that are hit and, oh, the deer wasn't killed. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. I've seen estimates that are closer to maybe 40,000 or 50,000 on an annual basis in terms of deer that are hit by motor vehicles. So it's a sizable number. Now, of course, that means there are lots of carcasses lying around on the roadside like you described. And those, I believe, are the responsibility of the counties. And generally, they have contracts with individuals who pick them up and haul them off to be either put in the landfill or whatever they're doing with them. But it's with county budgets and whatever the contract reads, it's certainly true that some of those carcasses seem to sit there for quite a long time. And sometimes you'll see them spray painted to indicate that they've already been reported, and I think they're just waiting for the contractor to come and pick them up. So that's not as, with the numbers that we're talking about, it's not as easy as you might think to just have them picked up and lugged away. But I think they try to do their best on that. But right now, it's a big problem, so watch out for it.
There you go. Thank you for calling, Sharon. Appreciate it. Let's go to Ken in Chicago area. Hi, Ken.
Good morning.
Morning.
Yes, my question is about the deer harvest, buck only, in a large portion of the state, and I'm wondering what the reasons are for that, and how long it's going to be that way. I understand that it's the first time since I think 1949 that you've not allowed does to be taken during the archery season.
Right. That's a major deviation from tradition, but it was deemed to be necessary in about, as I'm looking at the season structure map here, I'm looking at maybe 5, 10, 15, about 20 deer management units, all concentrated in the northeastern corner of the state, from about Marinette, straight west to Merrill, and then north up to about the northern boundary of Oneida County, then west again, and then north to Ashland, with the addition of Unit 13 over near Sawyer County. So there's a pretty big chunk of the state there where there will be no antlerless harvest, including archers, and that was deemed necessary because of what hunters themselves reported as a dramatic reduction in the herd over the past couple of years due to winter weather, perhaps harvest issues. I mean, people will throw everything into the soup there. Well, too many wolves, too much harvest, sunspots, moon phase, a whole host of other things. But the reality was, and the managers agreed, the herd was depressed enough in that area that it was warranted to reduce the antlerless harvest for at least a year. I don't think it will last too long. And then once the herd has rebuilt, go back to a normal season structure. So these are extraordinary regulations, but statewide it's probably, you know, no more than 15% of the state. Elsewhere,
well, we have about 70 units, I think, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, elsewhere there are there is a mosaic of different regulations, including the chronic wasting disease areas, traditional hunts, earn a buck, or not earn a buck, rather, but herd control units. And if for anybody who is not sure of where they're going, they should get the season structure map and be familiar with the regulations.
Mm-hmm. Great. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Heidi, we'll go to you now in Wild Rose. What's on your mind?
I live in Wild Rose, Wisconsin, and we have a fish hatchery here, so we have a real abundant amount of bald eagles in the area. But about a week ago, there was a dead deer off to the side of the road, and I was amazed to see a huge golden eagle sitting on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, are they making a comeback, or was I just lucky enough to spot one?
Well, this is always, depending on where you are in the state, there's always a debate that rages about whether people are seeing golden eagles or immature bald eagles. But if you know what you're looking at, golden eagles are being seen and apparently are seen quite regularly and in substantial numbers in a band along the Mississippi River maybe even with the Twin Cities down to the south. And there may be perhaps 100 or more golden eagles there at any one time. So they do move around. People are seeing them. If you have a bird book or you're a birder or you know what you're looking at, I don't doubt for a minute that you saw a golden eagle sitting on a deer carcass.
Yeah. We even have some up on my Facebook page, some photos of goldens. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you can see some pictures there.
They're impressive, so that's what you saw. And by the way, your fish hatchery there is a very nice, newly remodeled hatchery, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's beautiful. I go there a couple times a year, and usually when I'm there, I do see a bald eagle or two, you know, marking their area, getting ready to catch a fish.
Well, it sounds like a nice place to try and take a tour of or visit because it's state-of-the-art as far as fish cultivation is concerned.
Yep, I'd recommend it to anyone. It's a really nice little tour.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Heidi, for calling. Again, you can go to my Facebook page. It's The Larry Mueller Show, and take a look. Cal in Sugar Camp, we go to you now. Hi.
Hi. My question is just a very short one. I was wondering when bears go into hibernation and also raccoons and possums. I want to put my bird feeder out. I'm out where it's quite wild, north of Rhinelander.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother had something shaking the seed of her bird feeder in Rhinelander. She's next to a little wild gully. And I know it's got to be a raccoon because those guys can get into anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to know when they're going to roll up for the winter. So I don't have any problems. She has to take it in every night now, which is really difficult for her.
Well, the bear situation is a little erratic because it depends a lot on the progression of fall weather. And we've had just a gorgeous fall this year.
Yeah.
It's just been really nice. And I think bears are still active. I think the sows and some of the younger ones seem to go down first. But it seems to me there have been reports of bears well into the deer season the past couple of years. So I don't really think you're entirely safe from a bear encounter until, until late November or the first part of December. And if it's a colder or earlier onset of winter, it's probably earlier than that. And some are certainly down, but there may still be some around. So that's not foolproof.
Okay.
And as far as the mid-sized mammals are concerned, possums, coons, things like that, although they will disappear and den up in really inclement, really cold weather, they never really hibernate or disappear for the whole winter. So if there's a thaw, for example, especially here in the southern part of the state, possums will be out rummaging around, as will coons and skunks and other animals that size during a warm spell or a thaw all winter. So there's no, I don't mean to be discouraging as far as the feeder is concerned, but if the feeder is well placed or in an area or suspended, if it's hard to get to, you know, put it on a pulley or something.
I'm going to have to do that under the eaves. It's on a shepherd's hook so she can see it from the living room.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I'll have to figure out a way to hang it. and put it on a pole.
I think that's the only relatively foolproof thing to do, but certainly in a normal winter, the presence of coons and possums and so forth is pretty limited, and they will stay out of harm's way most of the time, but it's possible they might be out and about.
Yeah, there's no way a possum was smart enough to do this, but I'm sure could have done it.
Thanks, Gal.
Well, thank you.
To Matt in Rice Lake. Hi, Matt.
Hi. My question is regarding the Frascata, the process of registering white-tailed deer after it's harvested.
Mm-hmm.
I know we have registration stations all over, you know, different cities, all over the state and things. But what type of training do those people go through at those stations? I guess I'm referring to, I had numerous instances this past couple of years where I've just been handed a metal tag, you know, because it's been too cold to go outside, that type of thing. Registering my deer.
Well, that's...
Who polices that, I guess, is what I'm really interested in.
To be honest with you, Matt, I don't know. I think that any, you know, any gas station, convenience store, bar or whatever that wants to volunteer to be a registration station can, and it seems to me they get 50 cents a deer or something for the registration. I've had the same experience as you have. I think a lot of people have, where, you know, the clerk behind the counter is either busy or disinclined to put a jacket on, or they look out the window and say, oh, there's a deer foot sticking out of the truck here. Just put this on the ear or antler or whatever, and away the people go. So if what you're concerned about is that there's room for some abuse of the system, you know, I suppose there is, but I think in the long run, most of the people running the registration stations have been doing it for a long time and are try to be as responsible as they can. But certainly with the size of Wisconsin and the number of registration stations, you do run into that occasionally. I don't think that there's, you know, there are things like spot checks or whatnot that try and enforce the system or try and get people to actually go out there and make sure that the registration tag is properly installed. I think of all the deer I've registered over the years, or probably that you have, Larry, most of them have been handled very well. You know, people come out and, oh, nice deer, or, you know, where'd you get it or whatever, and they tag it properly and you go about your business. And in the chronic wasting disease areas, when you're going to DNR manned registration stations, I mean, it's lockstep here. Where'd you get the deer? Pointed out on the map. It's legally tagged and registered, and away you go. So I understand your frustration and concern that there may be some things slipping through the cracks, but overall, the registration, mandatory registration system has been great for Wisconsin in terms of providing a long-term database on deer harvest, and everybody's trying to do the best they can.
There you go. Thanks, Matt, for calling. Appreciate it.
I guess, Larry, if somebody really saw what they thought were abusive or negligent practices, that's probably worth a call to the local warden and say, hey, we were at, you know, the Acme Widget Company, and they were just throwing tags out the window or something. That's something that people should report.
And as long as we're on deer hunting, someone else emailed in and wondered if you could spend a little more time talking about deer hunting etiquette, since it kind of came up in a way, or hunting etiquette in general came up with the spotlight discussion, and I think somebody wanted a little more.
No, boy. Etiquette, or ethics, hunter behavior, all fundamentally the same thing, and I would hope that most hunters going through hunter education, being mentored by someone who's an experienced hunter, being part of a deer camp, that the ethics are passed along so that most of our hunters are responsible and they respect private landowners and they don't leave gates open and they don't tear around in some farmer's field. And they ask permission and they, you know, they don't take shots at deer that are unsafe. And if they find somebody else's deer wounded, that they make every effort to find who shot it. And I know, I mean, there are hundreds of things we could talk about here, Larry, but collectively, they're all considered the ethics of a person who's an experienced hunter and knows that it's in the interests of themselves and all other hunters to behave in the best possible way in terms of a quick, humane harvest. Well, you could go through all sorts of things, but the way you treat other hunters, the way you treat members of your group and landowners, and how you treat the animals themselves is all part of that. And we can only hope that there's enough written about that, that there's enough on the various media that hunters are watching, or that as particularly kids are brought up in the ranks, that they become ethical sportsmen, and that's good for everybody.
I've got an email here from Deborah. She said, last month I called and spoke with another wildlife expert guest who was on the show. My question was about ducks that were feeding on my suburban yard, corn and sunflower seeds coming in by the hundreds. It was recommended that I stop feeding them. Well, I have, but they continue to come multiple times a day, yet there's no more there for them than whatever seed might have fallen from my bird feeders. In other words, she's no longer feeding them. So she's wondering, what's the solution? I hate to think they're starving because their former source of food is gone. I don't think that's the case.
Well, I don't think that Deborah needs to worry about that. Generally speaking, these animals, whether they're songbirds or ducks or squirrels or anything else, are pretty resourceful and generally don't depend on a single food source. I think the advice, I'm not sure where it came from, but the advice to stop feeding in an urban environment, which concentrates the ducks and perhaps exposes them to flying around power lines or across busy roads or whatever, was probably reasonable. But again, if you've got a feeding operation and a few ducks are coming in and you can keep it at that, well, you know, that's no particularly big deal. But I think the ducks are behaving much the same as the family dog does when, you know, a pork chop hit the floor after dinner 6 weeks ago, but the dog visits the site of that pork chop like it was a shrine every night at dinner time, thinking there might be another one. It would take a while for that behavioral. If she'd been feeding them for a long time, it'll take a while for that behavior to stop.
Yeah, it might not stop for another month or two, or, you know, even through the year. But by next year, hopefully.
New ducks, new time, not feeding at Deborah's house.
And, I was just going to take a call from Reed here, but we lost Reed. Our guest today, Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Here with us until noon on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
When an earthquake hit Haiti last January, Haitian-American novelist Edwidge Danticat was safe at home in Miami. What is the role of emigre artists when things go wrong back home? Danticat's answer, create dangerously. I'm Jean Faraca. Join us today at 3 here on Earth.
Contributors to WPR include the UW Center for the Humanities, presenting Feeling Queer. UW faculty talk about the history, politics, and rhetoric of bullying. This Thursday, 7:30 p.m. at the Hillel Foundation, 611 Langdon. Humanities.wisc.edu.
Talking wildlife today with Scott Craven. Scott, a Ladysmith muskie fisherman, Paul Priest, a month ago pulled in a 51-inch albino muskie from the Thornapple flowage in the Flambeau River, the southwest of Ladysmith.
It was a beautiful fish.
It was a beautiful fish. It really was. But, man, that's the first one I'd ever seen. The question was, how common is it? Well,
I've never caught one. But, wait, I've never caught a muskie, period. I'm still working on it.
I've caught a lot of muskie, but I've never caught an albino, and that is really a rare event.
It was a beautiful fish. It was a beautiful muskie, but it was a beautiful fish because of the albino situation, and it's very rare, obviously.
You're not going to see it. Jesse in Watertown, your turn. Hi, Jesse.
Hi. My question is, I bow hunt in the CWD area, and it's all Ernebuck. Do they have any plans of maybe just getting rid of this Ernebuck program, even in CWD?
It's my understanding that a month or so ago, when the 15-year CWD management plan passed the board, that they were looking at probably 5 years here before a major review, and that Ernebuck would likely be on the table in the CWD area for quite a while. Quite a while, and, you know, maybe indefinitely. I don't know what to tell you about that. I mean, it plays to mixed reviews with the hunters, but, they feel that that's an important tool in keeping the herd down there as low as they can possibly keep it as they battle the disease. So I think it's going to be around for a while.
Okay, because my two cents of it is, you know, I bull hunt almost every day, and, you know, I'm not even seeing many does, let alone some bucks.
Well,
the few times I see them, it's been bucks. It's been my luck.
Yeah.
I understand your concern, Jesse. I make some of the same observations myself in that area, but that's something you're going to have to take up with your agency representatives.
Yeah, that is for sure. Thanks for calling. Byron in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Byron.
Hi. I've got some land on the Prairie River up north of Merrill, and I wanted to comment on my experiences with hunters and their respect for the land. I have trout fishermen using the land all summer long. They walk along the river and mm-hmm. fish and so on. And at the end of the summer, I might find one little package of a paper wrapper for a leader or something. The deer hunters come in, and there's trash from one end to the other in a week. Yeah. How extreme it is, I went up there a couple of years ago before deer hunting season. Someone had widened a trail along the lake shore, which included cutting down a bunch of trees and small trees and things along the shore, so they could come in with an ATV and build a deer stand about 15 feet high, nailed onto the tree. They cut a path off into the woods for a shooting lane, mounted a big barrel full of grain with an automatic feeder to lure the deer.
I hope you turned them in.
I put a note on it saying if it wasn't down within a week, I was going to report it to the DNR and to the sheriff for trespassing.
Mm-hmm.
It disappeared. But they're really the reason people... I've never posted the land. I'm about ready to post it because I'm getting tired of picking up the crap that they leave all over the place.
Well, no one could blame you for that, Byron. I'm glad you called because this is one of those things where one really bad experience or some, you know, deer hunters are pretty traditional in terms of where they go, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if you're being victimized, so to speak, by perhaps the same general group of folks year after year, and if their behavior is less than desirable, then, you know, maybe it takes something like being pinched for trespass or littering or whatever before they're going to come around. It's painful to hear stories like that because, as we talked about, we would hope that hunters would have a little more common sense. If they don't, it's imperative to realize that the bulk of Wisconsin is owned by private landowners, and therefore our ability to hunt or recreate or use those lands is entirely dependent on the goodwill of those private landowners. And part of a hunter's responsibility is to know when they're on private land as opposed to public land and to treat it the way they'd like their own land treated. And if you're being victimized by a group or an individual who's less responsible than that, I can only hope that maybe they're listening and they'll clean up their act because it's tough to hear that kind of thing, Byron, and hopefully it's not widespread.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Reuben in Burnett, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Reuben.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I was wondering where you can sell raw furs. It's you catch something, why you can't take it any place anymore to get rid of the raw hide.
Well, there are still fur buyers around. They may not be as widespread as they once were, but there is certainly still a fur industry, and there's much fur passing through the fur auction house here in southern Wisconsin. If you can't find a fur bearer, my suggestion is you get a hold of the Wisconsin Trappers Association. Yeah. The WTA, I believe, has a website, and they have a directory of their members. I'm sure they can put you in touch with a fur buyer. And in the absence of that, the DNR has a fur bearer specialist on their Wildlife Management Bureau team, and you could get to him through the DNR website and probably get some advice there. But first thing I do is go to the Trappers Association, and next in line, your local DNR office, and if that doesn't work, go to the fur bearer specialist.
Yep, there you go. Thank you, Reuben, for calling. Mark in Onalaska, on to you. Hi, Mark.
How you doing today?
Good.
Gorgeous day. I was listening, caught the end of the discussion about jack pine and how to cultivate it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in a long time ago in school at Stevens Point and was in summer camp, and we took a trip to in Owens, Illinois, back when we used to have paper companies actually managing land for timber.
Mm-hmm.
And they were using scarification. What they did is they clear-cut it, mm-hmm. whatever was on there, usually jack pine, but also mixture. And then they would scarify it with
kind of like a disc apparatus.
Like a disc.
Yeah.
And that would then expose the dark soil, and when the sunshine would then get the soil temperatures up enough that the cones release their seed. So that's another option for doing that. It's fairly intensive, but it works.
So while they need heat, they don't actually need the direct heat of, say, a forest fire kind of thing.
Yeah, they just need enough temperature, and I forget what the temperature that it gets to. But
okay.
Good to know. Thank you.
Yeah, the other thing is, recently in northeast Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and I know why they're only shooting bucks with bow and arrow up there. We saw absolutely no deer sign in the woods whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, that was
those folks are really hurting for deer up there.
That was a common observation last year, and I think there was enough of that it resonated with the decision makers, and the decisions are what we have now, which is leave the deer alone essentially for a while and let the herd rebuild.
Yeah. But the other comment, I was with a retired wildlife manager, was this is not habitat for deer. The forest was too mature.
Some
areas, sure.
Yeah, but a lot of the area in the national forest and the state forest, unless they do something to set it back to more pioneer species, it's not habitat for deer.
Right, that's true. We're losing aspen acreage and forests are maturing, and there are other changes too. But for whatever reason, including forest habitat change, the deer herd was greatly depressed, and this is the management response. So we'll see how it plays out.
Thanks for calling. Richard in the town of Barnes, where we actually have a cabin. Let's go there. Hello, Richard.
Hi, Larry and Scott. I called once before with the car chasing wolf story. I don't know if you remember.
A while back.
Well, Monday morning, I was on my way to the post office. I'm a mailman, and there was a bear laying on the side of the road, which obviously had been hit. So I backed up and put my lights on and got out. Kind of shoved it with my foot a little, and you know, no sign of life. It wasn't rigor mortis yet, but so I grabbed by a front paw and drug it off the road a little bit, and pretty soon the rib cage started moving up and down.
Uh-oh.
And then the bear kind of raised its head and gave a sigh. I thought it was kind of a neat story. I've been telling people I gave the bear CPR.
And how long did it take you to get back in the car after the bear sighed?
Well, I didn't hang around too long.
I don't imagine.
It wasn't a very big bear.
Oh, well.
Big enough to do some damage.
I'll be up in your neck of the woods in about 2 weeks. Thanks, Richard. Oh, that's a good story.
That's a good story.
I like that. Reed in Barneveld. On to you. Hi, Reed.
Yeah, I'm a naturalist for a nature sanctuary and preserve just north of Barneveld.
Mm-hmm.
The last few years, we've been planting some tamaracks in the low wet area on the preserve. And just in the last week or so, the deer have started grooming their antlers on my little tamaracks big time.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, I was told that hanging some tinsel on the tamaracks might scare them off, so I've been doing that this morning. I'm wondering if you think that would be effective or something else would be more effective. And two, I'm wondering why they seem to be gravitating specifically to my poor little tamarack instead of all the other things.
I can't tell you that, Reed, because in my case on my property, it's some willows that I brought down as cuttings and put in. And the willow bushes are pretty good size now, maybe 3-4 feet high and 5 or 6 feet wide. And although there are many things around the willows, including some finger-sized aspen and other things you'd think, oh, what a perfect pole for a buck to rub on, they just tear the life out of those willows. I mean, just tear them up to the exclusion of everything else. And it may be, I don't know whether there's some sort of smell or resin or just the right give, but for some reason, deer seem pretty selective in terms of what they attack. How many tamaracks are you talking about?
Planted 65 over the last 3 years, and right now I'd say about 50 of them are still viable, but I don't know how many are going to survive after the brooming.
I had pretty good luck a couple of seasons where the deer were really beating up things along my little walking trails, just going along with a squirt bottle of a spray of a deer repellent called Plant Skid, which is based on blood. And I just squirt some of that on the stem at about deer height. And, you know, this, I don't know how long this stuff would weather, whether it would protect them all winter or not, but at least for the rubbing period, I had pretty good luck with that stuff. And there are other repellents, too, that provide an odor-based repellent that I think would probably work better than tinsel or things like that, that if the wind isn't blowing, I think the deer are going to ignore it.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't had any problem with them feeding on the tamaracks, but just like in the last week or so, they've been just, you know, brooming them terribly.
But I think the blood smell was enough to keep them from rubbing on there. So it might be worth a try.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Scott, we're looking at in about the last minute here of gifts. Christmas gifts, holiday gifts.
Well, the holiday season is coming up, and you know, we talk about this every year, but there are so many cool things now that an outdoors person would like as a holiday gift, or even would-be outdoors people, or even if you're not so outdoorsy, you know, I think about bird feeders and maybe a sack of food to keep the feeder going. Anybody would appreciate some nice optics, a good pair of binoculars to be observing or seeing these things, or up close that they're seeing out the window. If you're wondering about the range of things, you know, just get a hold of the catalog or go online to one of the big outdoor retailers like Bass Pro or Cabela's. It's unbelievable. Memberships and conservation groups make a nice gift, and maybe turn somebody on to a group like DU or Pheasants Forever or Whitetails. Books, magazines, the outdoor news format is very popular here in Wisconsin, yeah, with outdoor news in terms of keeping abreast of what's going on. Trail cameras. Another neat gift. Wildlife art. You go on and on.
We'll do it in December. Thanks, okay. Scott. Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest. He will be back the first Wednesday of December, and we will do this all over again. Thank you for listening. President Obama's speech coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.